My name is Fernando Lozano. I am interviewing Mr. Ore Felder on August the 3rd, 1973. Mr. Felder was born in Bishop, Texas, near the Concordia community on January 1915 and has lived in Bishop, Texas since 1915. Mr. Felder has been working with the post office since 1949 and is the postmaster in Bishop, Texas at the present. Mr. Felder, could you tell us some of your early experiences as a resident of Bishop, Texas?
Of course, I have to hand down from what my father told me, because he was an early settler here and came here into Bishop in December in 1910. And my mother came here with her family in January of 1911. This was about the time that Bishop first got its name, from the stories that my father tells me. And Bishop was did not even have a post office at that time. It was just the post office wasn't open until later in January of 1911. The first months or so of my father was here, he had to go to Kingsville to get his mail, or it would be brought by wagon from Kingsville to a grocery mercantile store in Bishop, and they'd pick up their mail there. In fact, the first time that he voted in this area was in Nueces County. He voted in Kingsville. At that time, Nueces County included the area that is now covered by Claiborne County and Jim Wells County, I understand. I can recall some of the early things, the early days of my life. Of course, everything was horse and buggy days. There were no automobiles. But I can remember when my father did buy his first automobile. And it was, they were pretty far between. You scare all the horses and everything else every time you drive down the street. The roads were all mud and boggy, pretty black clay out east part of Bishop. In fact, wheels would ball up to where they wouldn't move. They just, everything would just lock up from driving in the mud. And of course, the roads were just a little more than trails. Of course, there was a gravel road going out east of Bishop that helped immensely for a number of years. But then, even in later years, this road broke down. I can remember even when I went to high school, it was pretty well gone, you might say. It had washed out in a lot of places from floods and so forth. So even the main street in town was just a dirt street. And everybody came in and tied their horses and so forth. And when it did come a rainy season, you can imagine it was a pretty boggy street to see wagons and everything bog right down the middle of the street. Then when I first started school, I started in a little brick schoolhouse that was about 6 miles east of Bishop, called the Red Brick Schoolhouse. And I went there for about 3 or 4 years. Then we moved about 3 miles up the road, and I went to another little country schoolhouse. And then in my sixth and seventh grade, I went to parochial school at St. Paul Concordia Lutheran Church, which is the center of the Concordia community. And then, of course, back in those days, you'd go through the seventh grade, and then you came on to high school, Bishop High School. I can't recall exactly the year when we finally started building us some paved roads, and things got a little better as far as travel was concerned. But going back a little bit on the area condition, the land was all in raw back in 1910, with exception of very few little farms that they were starting to break up this land with big steam plows. They were big machines. And I can still remember a few of those standing around that after they had been worn out. They just didn't last very long, apparently, from cutting down the heavy brush and things. And they would just stand there to rust after most of the land was broken. But everybody farmed with mules. There, later on, there were a few tractors. They called them Twin Cities or Moline tractors. And finally, a Fordson tractor came out. And there were a few of those around, but they were an accessory to farming. Mules were still the main thing. Big farmers to have 60 mules on a place, you'd see them in several places. And then at those days, it was cotton. Most of it was cotton. You plant enough feed to feed your mules because there was no sale for grain at all. They fed the mules, and then everything went to cotton. And I could remember when here downtown Bishop had 7 gins. And there were 2 on the west side that I can remember, and there were 2 on the east side. So that's 11 gins that we had, cotton gins that we had back in those days. So you can imagine how much cotton there was here. Then everybody was picking cotton for, not for 1 month or so, but maybe 3 months, all the way to October and nearly to Christmas before we got through with it.
Who did the labor?
It was all hand picking.
I mean, what? Were Mexicans?
Or right. These came from down the valley, and they came from around here from what they might call migratory labor. Of course, those things developed a little later, the migratory labor areas, like there was a big one in Robstown. But a good deal of the labor came. Well, not just all Mexicans. There were groups of colored people that came from Central Texas, and there were a lot of white people, too. I can remember one year that 2 white boys and my daddy and mother picked nearly the whole crop. That was after the war. That's when I was a very small boy, about, well, I think I must have been about 4 or 5 years old. And they picked the 4 of them, would every day pick a bale of cotton, and daddy'd take it to the gin. They were on it for a couple of months that way. And they got the whole crop in, finally did it that way. Of course, we had a lot of floods, and a lot of time we lost a lot of that cotton. Oh, gee.
Droughts.
Yeah, then we had droughts. I could remember some of them back as far as 1925, it was pretty bad. And around 33, there was some more. Of course, then the Depression was on. And then we were big enough to work, and we had to do all the labor ourselves, including picking most of the cotton as a family. We hoed all our own cotton, plowed it all ourselves. Those were the days of still with mules.
What can you remember of the Depression as it affected Bishop?
Well, as I recall it, the farmers, we did. We tried to live at home as much as possible. We had our own pork, we had our own chickens, we had our own beef. And the farmers out there, they started what they call a beef club. And the way they worked this, you get about 25 or 26 farmers would go together. And on every Saturday, one of them would have a fatted beef ready to be killed. So they would kill this beef, and on Saturday morning, usually 2 butchers, 2 of them would be volunteer butchers. They would go and cut this beef up early on Saturday morning, go to work at 2 o'clock. In fact, my daddy worked at that for about 2 years. I know several of my uncles worked at it for a good many years. And then these 26 people come and they get a beef, they'd get a roast, so much steak, and 1 soup bone or whatever they could get, you know. Then maybe next week it was another man's turn to do that. And we had no freezers, see? There were no such thing as freezers. And you had a meat market, but you couldn't keep that meat. You take it home, you had to eat it. Well, this way, we had good beef, and we could kill our own animals, and didn't have to buy it. Of course, everything was dirt cheap to begin with. I can remember then that I was with the FHA program, and we had some choice pigs that we fed on the FFA program. And as I recall, I think we got 4.5 cents a pound on the hoof farm. That's a big variance between that. And just nobody bought anything that we didn't have. My daddy farmed, would sharpen his own sweeps for his plows. I can remember that I had to come down to town and get some old coal, and we put it in that blower, and he'd take it to the shop, hammer those sweeps out. You just didn't spend a nickel if you didn't have to. Then I can remember a lot of time we hired labor for 75 cents a day. And that wasn't just 8 hours. That was from sun up to sundown. But then we didn't have the 75 cents a day. We did it ourselves a good many times. A lot of people lost their farms. They let them go back. There's nothing they could do about it. And they just...
Did the banks have any effect on the Depression?
Well, the banks were getting... They couldn't loan any money because they were afraid. They could see everybody was going broke. They didn't want to stick out their necks either, because the bank could make a lot of loans to people like that. They would go broke too. They weren't the same. Well, one bank closed up during that time. So it was pretty hard for everybody. But one thing about the farmer was that he could survive if he managed it properly, because he could have all his own food stuff. And the basic things that my parents bought, one was flour. And then they'd buy some syrup. And that was just about it. What I mean, sugar. Those were about three commodities that they had to buy. The rest of them, we'd raise them ourselves. Can a lot of things. We can our own pickles and all that sort of thing. Just had vegetables and grew up to be healthy and strong. I think maybe the food was healthier than it is now, and it's got all the preservatives in it.
There was some hurricanes, I understand.
Oh, yes. The first hurricane hit in 1916 that I don't remember too much about. But then there was a bad one in 1919. And this is when one of my second youngest brother was born right at that time. That was very severe. Not as severe here, though, as it was over in Corpus Christi. The 1916 tore this town up real bad. In fact, it took the top stories off a lot of the brick buildings. And you can still see where they were put back. My daddy used to show me what part had blown off, and then he came and they had to replace those bricks. And some of them that were two stories, they made one story out of them after that. This was in 1916. The report was that storm had centered and hit this Bishop area. 1919, of course, hit Corpus, and this was very destructive. A lot of people lost their lives. And I can remember going there in Corpus many months after that and see that lumber stacked at North Beach, you know, that had washed in from everywhere and from houses there and no telling from other places in the islands where it was terrible. See old sewing machines and bathtubs and everything around what was Breaker's Hotel. It was unbelievable. And, of course, we've had some hurricanes since then. There have been more recent years, a lot of them that sort of skirted us with just heavy rains and floods, but it never did any severe damage. The first one that we had after that, of course, was here. It was a couple of years ago. Carla missed us a little bit to the north. And then there's, what was that one in between there? I'm trying to think of the name of it. We had a little over 100 miles. We went about 4 years ago. But we survived all of them. The strong storms, my daddy was in the carpenter. He was a carpenter in the early days. And I can remember him telling that that every house went off the blocks. They all had cedar blocks. You know, they would tear loose and push off. And he would be raising houses for months and months at a time. Just as he got to them, sometimes the floor would be bulged up because a post would be right under the middle of the room, you know. And he'd get under there, and all the man's chickens were under that house, trapped. He said sometimes they were just pale and white. They could hardly walk because they'd been trapped under this house for 2 or 3 weeks, you know. And he finally raised them. They tried to come out there. Some of them had died under there. He went under there for shelter, and his house just came down on top of them. Then had a severe hailstorm. I can remember that. That was, must have been about 22 or 23, somewhere along there. A hailstorm came up from the... There was a lot of hail during that part of the time, because I can remember that they put a heavy hardware cloth over the top of the screens on the houses to keep from knocking your screens out. But when this hailstorm struck, it just took the first two hails to knock screen, hardware cloth, and everything out. It even took the cross pieces out of the windows, you know, where they had panels. And I can remember we were children, and my daddy came running in the room, and he grabbed us and pushed us under the bed. And it just lasted a few minutes. But the feed, the cotton, it was about 5 foot high, you know, just full grown. And in 2 minutes' time, it wasn't just stubble, it's just about 2 inches. It just grounded up like you'd put it through a mill. It's unbelievable. Ice stayed on the ground even till next day. There were pieces there of ice that say they measured several inches long. They were just like they were chipped off of a block. And the farm we used to live, I went by there some years ago, the old tin roof still looked like somebody taking a sledgehammer and just beat it. This is one of the worst hailstorms we had here. We had a lot of small ones that just took in small areas, but at that time, it knocked out every window for a strip about 2 miles wide from 6-7 miles west of town till about 10 miles east of town. It just hit that wide. The severe part was right through. It just took every window out of all of those houses from the west to the north side. And they were months and months getting enough glass in here to replace those windows.
Can you remember anything back in the Prohibition days, some of the things that, you know, were existing?
I can't remember too much about Prohibition. I can just remember that after Prohibition had started, that we had a bunch of old beer bottles that they'll be laying around, and we didn't know, we wondered what they were for. They said, well, at one time they sold such a thing as beer, you know, and then Prohibition came and didn't use it anymore, and it was outlawed. I can just remember me talking to my mother, because see, that was, Prohibition must have started about 1917, somewhere right after the war. I was just about 2 years old. And then the best thing I knew about beer was that 3X, that was root beer, that took the place of it. They called it near beer and root beer. I can remember that.
Was there any smuggling or anything like that, bootlegging taking?
Not the first year. I can remember later years, in about the 20s, late 20s, the homebrew, you know, people started making homebrew. And of course, this was not for sale, but everybody could make it on his own. And you buy some Pabst Blue Ribbon malt, you know, and a little yeast, and you'd get your 10-gallon crock, and some of these people saved some ketchup bottles or whatever they could find, and they'd make them some homebrew, and they'd cap it too early, and it'd all go off like bombs. Especially those ketchup bottles, you know, they're not very strong. Of course, it was a kind of a refreshing drink, and it served the purpose. And then I could remember a few of them that would make it and bootleg it and get caught, because it was illegal to sell it. You know, you could make it only for your own use. Of course, after 1932, was it, when we got back to beer, I think this thing pretty well died down. I didn't hear much about it anymore. However, I was in the store here not too long ago, and I saw they had Pabst Blue Ribbon malt, so there may be a few people still making it, I guess. That's a good substitute anyway.
There's some legends about Bishop, you know, a lot of folklore and legends. Do you remember anything? Superstitions? Another was Mother Lane. I don't know if you remember.
Her. Yes, I remember Mother Lane.
And the new mooners, you know, the ones that came, they call the new mooners. Can you remember something on her?
Yeah, well, I can remember that she was located up here close to Francisco Garcia's store, and he finally put in a string of tourist cabin. There were so many people that came here. And I can remember some of my mother's relatives that came here. And they had problems, you know, rheumatics, and they had this and that, and they thought that this lady really helped her, you know. In fact, I heard one of them say that, she could rub stones out of you, you know. And one of them said, thought he believed it so strong, he said she'd rub a double-row cultivator out of me. He said, I'd still believe it, because it really helped me. Although some of them were ridiculing it, there was, you know, really no help in that. But this went on for a good many years, and I can remember that she was still around here when I first went to work in the post office, but she left some years after that. But to my surprise, about 2 or 3 years ago, some people from way up in the north, either Missouri or Illinois somewhere, asked me if I knew what had happened to Mother Lane. They were traveling through here, and they were still trying to find her. Somewhere they had heard somebody where she'd helped somebody. But right now I don't know that anybody knows whether she's still living or not. But I used to get mail here addressed to me, trying to get it to Mother Lane if I could.
There's been some talk, you know, about some of the activities that took place after the wars, you know, some of the feelings, you know, about the, you know, talking to some of the people that talked about the Ku Klux Klan.
Mm-hmm.
Were these groups anti-Mexican, anti-German, or what?
I guess they were anti-German during the war, because, see, we were at war with Germany. And I really never could figure out just what they were trying to achieve, but I know that some people had taken some beatings here that were German people, and I don't know if it was for what they said or just for the attitude they took. And of course, it was the Ku Klux Klan that was behind it. And what I can remember is what I've heard. And then I can remember that the only thing I really remember is when I, as a child, saw them going around with these hoods over their faces at a funeral one time, and I didn't know what was going on, you know. But then soon after that, when our governor abolished the, or made it illegal for them to wear those hoods, masks as they called them, why, then I kind of recalled seeing those things, and not too much was said about it. And now, in recent years, when I read some about some other states still having Ku Klux Klan, it kind of is, it's kind of a reminder to me. I never did really find out what their motives were in this area, other than to, well, they were trying to take it out on the German people that were here, of things that happened in the war.
Were there any lynchings or anything like that?
Any what, sir?
Lynchings or things?
I can't recall any lynchings here. Not to my knowledge. I don't recall any of them.
Were these people mostly wealthy people or well, middle class? Or
you mean the ones that were in the Klan?
Yes, sir.
They were some of the prominent people. Yes, they were. Because I, in later days, I had them pointed out to me. Well, soon after they said so-and-so, he was a member of it. And I know, I can have about, I have about half a dozen stick in my mind that I know that that were back in those days. They were usually out of the prominent group. And I think they were, in a lot of cases, misinformed people. You know, this has always been my opinion about it. But back in those days, the ethnic groups, they were close groups. You found that with the Latin or the, well, any ethnic groups. The Germans, they were a pretty close-knit group then. So were the Czech and the others, and some of them in some states and some areas still are. I think they still hold together, just like you mentioned the Latin people. I think they, to a certain extent, have their groups. They stick pretty close together to their ethnic groups and their customs and their ways. It's not like it used to be. It's a lot more intermingled than it was back in those days. Because a lot of these, I can remember some people that couldn't even talk English. A lot of the Germans couldn't talk English. They talk German. That was it.
Did they have regular meetings or what?
Well, no, I don't think that they had meetings other than they had their lodge. They had a lodge, and I think some of those are still going. But I think that anybody could be members of them. I don't think they were any close. They had their own fire insurances that, for many years ago, that was they were strictly all German people. They have a mutual fire insurance, and I think some of those companies are still going, but they're no longer restricted to ethnic groups. They've done away with that part of it. And the biggest activity was around their church. They didn't have the social activities that they have now, or the extra organizations that churches have now. That was mostly the Sunday service, and that, you know, that was it. Now you have, of course, women's group, young people's groups, men's clubs, and all this kind of activity that back in those days in the rural community you didn't find. It was, Sunday was the only time that you put on your Sunday suit. The rest of the week you left in the closet. Sunday shoes too. You had a pair you wore just on Sundays. You didn't wear most of the week.
There's somebody that was a colored, I don't remember, somebody that came, a doctor, I believe, that was jailed and the jail burned down. Do you remember anything in that incident? It happened some time back, I don't know what year it was. But supposedly this doctor came to cure, you know, blacks from San Antonio, I believe, I'm not sure.
I can't ever remember that story. Of course, I lived in a rural community, and
I wonder what the feeling was, you know, yeah. At that time, you know.
What
was the result?
He must have not been a local person or something. That it was a story that sort of blew over in a short period of time, because I can't recall him ever talking about it. I can remember a bank robbery that we had here a good many years ago, and of course, I knew a lot of the people that worked in the bank at that time. It must have been around the early 30s or somewhere. I can remember seeing a car that had been stolen and captured with a bunch of bullet holes. A lot of these people, everybody pulled their six-shooter out of the cash register, started shooting at them. They put a bunch of holes, and they got away, but they didn't steal any money. They finally caught them up with them. the bank was pretty well secured. They held tight. They didn't let him out. One of those old banks where they had these wire cages. Well, our first post office was that way when I went to work. And it was all bars, you know, and you couldn't crawl over those counters very easy. They just ducked down and grabbed their pistol and started shooting under the window through the old heavy marble plate. That marble started jumping off. And although the fellow had a machine gun in the window and was boring holes through the wooden floor right over his back, he was pecking down here with a six-shooter. And the marble was chipping off, and finally they took off and run with a machine gun and didn't left the money, didn't rob it. But it was a lot of excitement for a time.
How was the social life at that, you know, in those years? I understand you didn't have very many things, but there were some social things going on.
Well, yes, sir. Really, yeah. One of the things that that we had in the community was always these, they called it a school picnic that went on for many, many years. When the end of school, we'd have a school picnic. This thing grew where we'd maybe have 700, 800, 900 pounds of barbecue, you know, and people would come out, especially in election year, even candidates would come out to this thing, and they'd come from high and wide. Bishop was pretty well closed down. Everybody would go to Concordia Community down there in Grove, where we had our picnics. And this was an annual affair. It is just in the last 9 or 10 years that it has sort of faded out. This took quite a bit of arrangement, a lot of work. This was one of the things that we as children looked forward to. Of course, way back there, prior to that, they used to have the Sons of Hermans, and this is the lodge I was trying to say something about a while ago. They had a hall out east of town, and they'd have dances, I don't know how often. But this was prior to my days, and that was torn down or moved away. It was moved away many, many years ago. But I can remember my daddy talking about it, that they'd have activities there. They'd come from the Driscoll area and all over because they were scattered and there were not too many people around. They'd go to Corpus Christi, they'd get on a wagon and they'd go over there with a wagon, of course. Go one day and come back the next day.
Transportation was done by wagon.
It was wagon or buggy, yeah. Of course, if they go to Corpus, they'd always talk about taking a wagon, you know, because they probably had some supplies and things that they want to get over there, and they just took their good old time. And those that wanted to celebrate on the way, why, they'd get a little keg of beer and they'd enjoy riding home, you know, with a keg of beer on the way. I hear them talk about that. But really, we didn't get over there very often. Going to Corpus Christi is like, you know, sort of like going to several hundred miles now. And he was a tremendously good salesman. You could tell that by selling all his raw land out here to people that lived in the city. Like my mother, she with her father had a grocery store in Central Texas, Milam County, Thorndale. And they were city people, and they came out here in the sticks, 9 miles out in the country from what was a little bitty town in the railroad switch, and started over. Of course, they said they cried many times why they came out in this forsaken country, but they got over it in time. But he was a real promoter. He did some promoting down in the valley some years later. And then quite a few years later, in the early middle 20s, he sold a lot of land around the Los Angeles, Texas area, which is close to Cotulla in LaSalle County. And my grandfather, again bought some land from him and moved out there. So the people back in those days, they had some foresight. They were always looking for something to go to. But really, personally, I didn't know him. Outside, I see these landmarks, and you see the house right west of the hotel has laid right in the sidewalk. F.C. Bishop, this is where he lived. The old house that the storm got here 4 years ago, he lived in that house at one time, too, and then, of course, he built this hotel. And when he laid out the town, he built sidewalks pretty well over the business area of town, and some sidewalks went for half a mile out to our warehouse way out there, which flooded, which now, in recent years, flooded several feet of water. But they laid sidewalks, they had real foresight, and saw a lot of growth in this town. But these outlying areas, they finally came and they sort of pulled together through the years, because the very depression years of town, if anything, got... Well, if you look at the statistics of the post office, it grew real rapidly about 1913, 14, and then after World War II, then it started drying up, you know. And it wasn't until the
30s, really, after the cotton production and one thing, the oil activity, and all these things started growing again. Of course, then when Celanese came about 26, 27 years ago, this started the growth in the area.
Who was the first one to start the oil and oil industry?
Well, as I can remember, they drilled some oil wells around and it looked like they never found any oil, and then all of a sudden they found oil in a number of places. I can't remember what company it was that really got started on the west side of town. And they had oil wells from about 2 miles west to way out, which is Champlin, which is the old Chicago Corporation that built the first plant out there. But there were numbers coming, Renoir, and there's a lot of names that don't stick in my mind anymore that started out there. And in the Luby area, there was, later on it was Pan American, but they had some, there were some other names. I can't recall it. Anyway, they had built 30 or between 30 and 40 houses out of this plant at the Luby Field. Then there were three complexes of houses on the west side that different oil companies had built. Southern Minerals was one of them. Chicago Corporation, Warner Plant was one of them. And then it's Renoir, that they call Renoir Company. It had a complex of houses out there. And then there was a smaller company closer to town here that sold out in later years. They drilled these wells and they flared this gas at night. And the gas was burning at night. There were just hundreds and hundreds of lights from here west of town all the way into Corpus Christi and going up towards Rockport. And this whole sky was just lit up at night. You didn't have to have any street lights. It was lit up. So then they started using this gas, you know, for natural gas. They start tapping, building the big inch and so forth. They, first thing you know, these lights were gradually going out and going out and going out until there were just none left. They were, I guess, wasting this gas. They had to bleed so much of it off for the oil to come out. And then I can remember about somewhere around 34 years ago when the first recycling plant was built west of town. And that was the first recycling plant in the world, I was told. And they drilled this well in the center of a group of wells, and they put this plant in. They stripped the fuel off of this gas, and they pumped the dry gas back into the ground so that the pressure would stay there. And really, they didn't know whether the thing was going to work when they tried the first one. They said the pipes, they were under so much pressure that they started crawling around like snakes, and it looked like the whole thing was going to blow up. But it was a good thing, and they started doing it all over the world. They just found out that this way they could keep the production up for over a longer period of time by reusing the pressure that they had. The oil industry really did a lot for this Bishop community. The beauty part of it was that it had the oil production, and at the same time they farmed the land for agriculture on the top. You can hardly find an acre of land here that's not in cultivation. It's just very few acres in the whole area that's not in cultivation. Of course, like I said a while ago, many years ago it was all cotton, and now it's going to more sorghum. So Bishop took on the name first. It was Cotton Capital of the Coast. Then it took on the oil and chemical industry of the Southwest, and then the grain mart that they added grain mart of the Southwest on. So those have been the big titles. But cotton is not the big title anymore, and the oil is not what it used to be, I'm sure. It's gradually diminishing. We see that all over. But the sorghum looks like it's taken on more and more. There's more demand for that. Like I said, many years ago, there was hardly a market for it other than feed your cow or your chickens with it. Now, it's used for so many things, plus that we export a lot of it even to foreign countries. It's a commodity like rice, I guess, in some other countries.
How was politics like in 1928? How did the people vote during Smith when he was running?
Well, as far as I know, there were always both parties, but I think the majority of it was Democratic, as far as I knew, that it's active. Of course, there was a lot of speech making and all. You don't see that anymore. I can remember even some 20, 30 years ago, a lot more speeches made. People really really go out and work. They still do it in some areas, I'm sure, but it was more obvious, you know, for a small community. We'd have these things where 20, 30 candidates would get together, you know, and then one would bash the other one, you know, and everybody had his two bits of why he wanted the office. And even I can remember when Lyndon Johnson landed with a helicopter right in the middle of town and made a short speech when he was running for the Senate. And just took off and moved to the next town that way. I think if people really got out to vote more than they did some years later, they got kind of lax on the thing. There were a lot of people this day and time, I don't know that they're vote like they did back in those old days. Of course, there were the probably some ethnic groups that didn't turn out for that. They didn't take the interest in politics or just were not as informed, especially housewives, I think, were not as informed back in those days as they are now. I think the women are more active in this day and time than they were back then. They were more or less housewives, and they kept the family together and fed and cooked and washed and didn't take as much interest in community affairs. Although there were some even back in those days that did.
How was school like when you were going? Teachers and...
There usually never was over one teacher in a country school, of course. They'd have all 6, 7 grades in one school. And I can even remember sometime when the older grades would have to help the teacher out in teaching the younger grades. You know, if somebody had trouble with his ABCs as we started back in those days, we'd have to help the younger ones when we had it. Of course, there's some advantage in that those that were on the bright side, they would overhear the fellow that was in the grade or two ahead of them, and when he got to be in that grade, he already knew it. And this is a concept that the school has looked into many times since then, and there's a lot of truth in that, because you can, some of those things I can remember, even that when they had it last year when I was in the lower grade, now I have it, I already knew the answer to it. It's unbelievable, but it works to some extent. I don't know if it's practical all the way through, but it does register that way with me. The schools, of course, we'd have to sweep the school when we'd have turns sweeping the school, you know, after school, and if we got there early, we'd have to build the fire when it was cold, and we'd have to go out and carry in the coal and things like that. These were expected, and we didn't think too much about it. And we just did the best we could. I think that some of them learned and more than others did, and some of them just didn't think the school was as important as it is in this day and time. Because if there was a lot of work to do on a farm, why, you just missed school. We never did. When school time was there, we went to school. We had to do our work before and after school, like milking 14 cows. And on Saturday, husking corn and shelling it for 100 to 150 hogs and maybe 40 cattle and grind feed for them and things like that. It kept us busy. We worked early in the morning, walked to school and come back from school and start feeding the livestock and milking the cows and have supper and then study your lessons. It's a different world than it was actually at that time.
Were the schools made up mostly of Anglo community, or was there other?
No, the first school I attended to, it was primarily Anglo. I guess it was in the area that it was. But then the next country school I went to had started quite a few Latin people were in that school, and I can remember several names. And I wondered what happened to them. We talked about it once in a while. I talked to somebody that knew them, and we were about nearly 50-50. I went to school at the Caldejaro community, which was about. But one time the school was in front of our house, and then we went down two areas consolidated, and then went 2 miles down the road. And, well, there was a little everything there. All ethnic groups were represented there. But like I say, there were not too many families back in those days. Not as many as there were in later years. And it's getting that way again in the country. There's less families in the rural area now than there were some 15, 20 years ago by far. I can tell it by our rural mail service. There's a lot of urban increase, but way out on the rural routes, it's getting more scattered all the time. As the old houses rot down, we've built a new home closer to town or in the town somewhere, or the newer generation don't live out the country.
When was the first post office built? Being in the post office for many years, you should have a pretty good account of
it. Well, I can remember it the first time. It was right next to the Bishop Drugstore, and in behind this post office, there was the doctor's waiting room, and then there was a doctor's office behind there, and the drugstore was right alongside of it. I think it was first in the inside of a grocery store lot. And fact is, I'm kind of proud of one thing, that we haven't had over 4 postmasters, and I'm the 4th one in the 60-year history. 62 years, in fact. Mr. Charlie Jones, he was a postmaster in Maine on January 1st, 1911. Then G. Doobie, on April 1st, 1922, and then Mr. L.C. Smith on September 16, 1935, and I was named June 2nd, 1949. So there's quite a stretch there. Well, in fact, 63 years that we just had 4 postmasters. Of course, the first ones, they were changed when the administrations changed. You know, they changed postmasters, but that law went out in the late 30s. So since then it's been under civil service. You mentioned something a while ago about post office, right? And I dropped it again. What was the other thing you asked about the post office? Oh, about the location? Well, it was just a narrow store, like a narrow store building. After they moved out of there, we were in a narrow building over there. It had no back to it at all. It was just a front door. And it got hot in there, and it, little ceiling fans, and the light, dim lights, we'd have a drop cord with one little light bulb in it. Then back about 20 years ago, we built a building, especially for the post office. It was a lease building. And we were in that building about 16 years. And then come the 10th of this month, it'll be 5 years that we're in this building, which we're really proud of. When I look at these lights now in here and I think about that one drop cord with that little 50-watt bulb in it, it's quite a change.
How was the mail delivery in the early 1900s?
Well, it's all by train. We had 4 passenger trains coming through here. And they would drop this mail at the depot, and the depot had a little mail room down, and we had what we call a mail messenger that would meet this train. And it haul it over to the post office in the wee hours of the morning. Sometimes they'd drop it in the little locker room over there, and then we'd go early hours of the morning and get it out of there. All the mail coming in and going out was by train, and it had to be, of course, it had to be sorted under schemes to protect the trains and the connections to that connection to get to the proper place. And these concepts, of course, have been changed drastically. Finally, they started what we call highway post office, which was similar to a train. See, a train had what we call a mail car on there, and it was a little post office in itself. It had this RPO clerk, as we call him, and he would work this mail for between here and Robstown. He'd sort it out, and he'd put it all in that sack and throw the sack off in Robstown, so on down the line, pick that up for the next town, and then make the connections with the other trains in Odom and wherever they had to go to. And it got to be a real complex thing. You had to know a scheme. At one time, in Texas alone, you had to make 2,100 separations on your separation case. And, of course, from there on out of the state, somebody else had to worry about the breakdown on those things. And now, with the aid of zip code and all these things, a lot of this thing has changed. Now, if you can read numbers, you can pretty well sort mail, because this is what it amounts to. Then we hauled some on buses for a number of years when the trains got pulled off. And finally, we just kept one train going, and this mail finally started moving by truck because of schedules and one thing or the other. We could mail our mail later in the day and get it early in the morning, and this helped immensely. The other way, you'd have to mail it in the morning, and they'd be riding the train all day to get as far as Corpus even, because it would go to Odom, and from Odom it may come back to Corpus and switch around and be all day getting there. It speeded up the service, although that we get a lot of complaints about delay in the mail. This day and time, there were delays there that some people could forget about, I'm sure.
How was it delivered here in Bishop?
Well, we had, first it was just one rural route, and later on there were two of them. Say there were two rural routes, and the roads were hazardous. They were terrible. They'd have these Model T cars, and they'd put real narrow tires on it. Some of the mail carriers even had fixed a barrel with water in it with two little pipes where it would drip on the wheels all the time to keep it from balling up. That mud was wet enough, it wouldn't stick. They used all kinds of things, and I can remember when the mail carrier used to deliver mail to our farm after the big floods. We had these quite often. He would go down this road, and he'd get stuck. He'd just get on top of his truck, and he'd wait for Daddy to bring some mules down and pull them out. The water would be, he'd have both doors open. The water would be flowing right through that Model T. He had to bail all up in the seat. And the next day, he'd look at it, and he'd think, I think it's a little better. He'd drive in it again and get stuck again, same old thing again. They'd get up in the morning, and one of my rural carriers retired 2 years ago. He'd deliver it with wagons sometimes, and horseback, and all kind of ways. It just got so bad that the car wouldn't move. It was common for those days for them to slip the front wheels out under a wagon and just have two wheels, like an old Roman chariot, and it come to town in it to get the groceries, because the mules couldn't pull the whole wagon. Mud was too sticky. Just ride on those front two wheels, and that fifth wheel, as we call it, goes under the wagon. And they delivered some mail that way. Now the rural carriers we can deliver all the mailboxes without putting a wheel in the mud. It's all weather road or paved road. With a few little detours, we can avoid all the dirt roads that we have. It's a big change, really.
How about the early churches and revivals? I understand they did have some.
I can remember when they had a lot of revivals, and you see some church groups that come put up a tent, and have services at different times. I never attended that because I was a member of the Lutheran Church, and we had our regular services, and we tried to make them, and like I said, that was about it. If you made your Sunday service every Sunday, why? For a farmer out in the country, that was about all the church activity he had. Say we didn't have the clubs and that kind of activity like they have now. But I do know that a lot of the churches here had revivals, and they've had those until not too many years ago, I can recall. They may call them something else now, but they still have them in a sense. And we have had some of those too, but they were, we called them mission festivals or something like that, you know. We'd have an annual mission festival. They'd invite an out-of-town preacher, and everybody would bring some food down, and they'd stay down at church at noon and to have a service in the morning, another one in the afternoon, have a visiting pastor from another congregation have a service in the morning, another one in the afternoon, and then we'd raise funds for mission work that would go to the districts and so forth. And in a sense, it was like a revival. Everybody sort of revived over hearing what was going on in other parts of the world, in the mission field and other states, and having a visiting pastor. It was an annual affair, and a lot of people looked forward to it. After the crop was gathered, in the fall of the year, they'd have a mission festival.
Was there a Catholic church then?
Yes, the Catholic church has been here quite a few years. It's still on the same location. I can't remember just what year that it was built, but I can remember when it went under construction. And it must be at least maybe 40, 45 years. So if there was one part of that, they didn't have their own building. They may have held services in another building. But I think a lot of the members always did attend. Keith was a prominent Catholic member, from what I know. But from what I know, Father Booz was one of the first Catholic ministers here, and he's my next door neighbor over here next to the post office. Now he's retired, you don't know him. He's very interesting to talk to. I enjoy talking to him because he's one of the did it the hard way out of the old field, old mission fields and things. He can tell you a lot of interesting stories about that.
There was, I understand there was quite a few activities going on Saturday. It's been a big day for people.
Well, everybody came to town on Saturday, that's true. And I can remember, we didn't get to come to town too often, but a lot of people did. And when later on, stores would stay open till late Saturday night, because this is the day everybody came to town. And I can remember my early years at the post office, we would sell money orders, especially cotton picking time. And we'd have them standing out of line, way out the street, everybody waiting for money orders. They would take this money and send it home. Well, in later years, you could see this diminished. Even the people that came here to harvest the crop, if they were from the valley, they'd go home for the weekend. They'd drive home for the weekend and come back Monday morning. They'd carry their money home with them. They didn't have to mail it. So there you saw a changing situation. But even many years before that, I can remember, and you can see some pictures here, a Saturday afternoon, how crowded the street was. No car could go down. It looked like a big carnival going on. But there were just cotton pickers from all over. And these dry goods stores, they'd do a booming business. Everything from cotton pick sacks to go the next week, be a big pile of them right at the entrance of the door. You could buy a 7-foot sack or 8-foot sack or 9. Later on, there were 11 and 14-foot sacks, you know. Oh, boy, I wanted to put 100 pounds in a sack before he'd go away. And I picked a lot of cotton in my days. I always enjoyed doing it. And I'd go out there for months at a time and pick cotton. Everybody see who could pick the most, you know. And they're foolish. They see how much you could put in one sack. You know, put 100 pounds of fluffy cotton in one sack. It's got to be pretty good chore to drag that around behind you. But I can remember that I would pick a race and we'd go to see who could make that 500 pounds a day, you know. You put in a pretty hard day, but unless you were a real artist at it, why, it's pretty hard to pick 500 pounds a day. We used to pick clean lint. If there was one little old speck in that cotton, you'd have to take it out and throw it out. Now they pull the whole burr and everything off. No, you had to clean it. It was just all white.
People pay with hard cash in those days?
Yes, sir. I don't think that they used checks like they did now. Most of them, it was cash over the barrelhead. They did credit business. I know that, especially during, well, even before the Depression, a lot of people worked on credit. The farmers had to borrow money to make their crops on, and they had to pay the banks back. It was between the banks. But they didn't write checks for everything like they do now. I'm sure about that. They'd buy something, they'd try to pay for it right out of the pocket. It was pretty well, the way all the business went. It was all cash with money.
How was the medical practice in those days? Was there any folk medicine, remedies, epidemics?
Oh, yeah, there were a lot of things that we did.
You know, at home, did sometimes you
make Yeah, if we had a bad cough, we'd get a little sugar in a spoon and put a little kerosene in it. You know, and that would help that cough, and it really helped. It was always said that you had to watch that you didn't get it in your windpipe because it may be fatal, you know. And we'd catch some cooties, you know what I'm talking about. You'd get lice, you know, something like that. Lice, we'd have to cure them too. We'd do the same thing. We'd get an old sock, you know, and you had to put kerosene on your hair and then keep that old sock on there for that many hours, and we'd kill them that way. I think they got medicine for all those things now. And some of those old remedies are pretty good. And sometimes, of course, if you had used some wine, if somebody had some old bad grape wine, well, it would help for this and help for that. And, it might even help for cough. You heat it up, and, it wouldn't taste good, but it would be something soothing and enough alcohol in it that where it would give you some relief for a bad cough or a bad cold. And just a lot of things were homemade. I can't recall all of them anymore. Of course, we had two doctors in town, and part of the time I think there were three of them. And I can remember they come out. I was born out in the farm. I didn't go to the hospital. My wife was too. My wife, incidentally, was born here too.
My $40 check.
I can remember, especially here, there's buggies back in those days. Of course, they make calls to the house. Somebody'd have to go into town, a neighbor would have to go into town and tell the doctor that so-and-so was sick, and then he would come out and make house calls. You didn't go to doctor's offices too much. Of course, you usually waited until you were so sick that you couldn't go to that, I guess. You tried everything else first. But I guess some of them survived, and some of them didn't back in those days. The doctor couldn't get there fast enough. But I can remember a number of times when we were sick, the doctor came out to see us, told us what to do, made it. But like I say, we were born out in the country, that's why we didn't even have birth certificates, because back in those days they probably made some record, but it didn't get into the state record, so there was no record to get belated birth certificates from people that knew us.
Well, thank you very much for your interview.
Well,
very interesting.
I hope that I have given you some insight or what I remember. It's kind of haphazard and chopped up, you know. You get the different thoughts come to you at different times, and they're not all in sequence the way they follow according to years or experiences, but I think maybe you can fish something out of that. It might be interesting.
Just didn't go there unless they had to. Now we can go there in 30 minutes, of course. It took one day to go and one to come. Of course, if you had to serve on a jury or something, then you'd go over there and you'd have to stay in a hotel till you got off the jury. I can remember my daddy having to do that a lot. There were not too many people, and he got called to serve on the jury quite often. Now there's so many more people in Nueces County. I guess they have more courts, too, but it don't look like you get as many jury sentences as they used to. We had a brass band out in our part of the country that I belonged to for about 16 years. And we would play at these picnics I was talking to about a while ago. And, of course, elections would come around. Some politician would invite us over to come and give a barbecue, and we'd go play the band. Even have to go in Corpus Christi, and we'd get on a big trailer truck and go drive right down the street playing with the band, go up a bluff, and nearly all fall off of the trailer truck. And this was all back in the days when they talked about farming, you know, blacklanders and things like that. And, of course, World War II came along. This tore us up, you know. The boys started going this way and that way. But at the same time we had this brass band, we also had string bands going. We always had something to do, you know. A group would get together and we'd have this string band. We'd play at weddings and keep a party lively. And we enjoyed that part of it. This was about the only thing we could do. Well, you could go to a movie once in a while, but we didn't do that. There's no such thing as television or anything back in those days. Radio. You remember we got our first radio at neighbors would all come over and listen. They couldn't imagine how in the world that sound could come out of that thing. They think there's something freaky about that thing. Now, it's a pretty common accepted thing, not just from here, but anyway out in space. What was it you smiling about?
Mr. Bishop.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Bishop. I never knew him really personally, but my daddy would talk a lot about it because he had a lot of dealings with my grandfather. Bought his land from Mr. Bishop. They were, my grandfather and father were from Travis County, close to Austin, a little town of Manor. This is where he was born. And he had been a constable up there in that county and so forth. But later years, they heard of this land development. These people from Central Texas were coming down here with these trains and inspecting this land. They'd buy it. And then they'd leave their friends and communities and everything and come out here with the rattlesnakes and start all over and break up this land and start tilling it. Getting back to Mr. Bishop, my daddy always described him as being a brilliant man. He said he's one of the smartest men he ever knew. He was real alert. He could just put figures together just at the snap of your fingers and things like that. He always admired him for that part of it.